Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 99 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Co-hosting with me is Rob Mark. Hi, Rob.
Good evening from Chicago.
Now, you're just barely back to Chicago. It seems like you've been doing a lot of traveling lately.
Yes, I was up in beautiful Milwaukee this last couple of days at the Regional Airline Association convention, where, of course, I had a chance to hang out with some other social media geeks and geekettes.
Sounds great.
Our friends, well, we'll talk about them in a bit.
Okay, very good. Also with us is David Vanderhoof. Hi, David.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Now, this is a bit of a special show, owing to the holiday weekend here in the U.S. We've got an abbreviated news segment focusing mostly on what you might call aviation oddities. And in lieu of a live guest, David comes
in. Are you talking about me specifically? Or
is the oddity?
Yeah.
I guess it's both of us.
I'm sounding a little defensive there, aren't I?
Yeah, you are.
Okay, sorry.
So in lieu of a live guest, David comes in with not one but six interviews. These are from the 2010 Joint Service Open House held May 14th through 16th. That was in Maryland. Is that right, David?
Yeah, Andrews is located approximately 5 miles out of D.C.
And all these interviews are with pilots, I guess, right?
5 out of 6 are with pilots. One is with the senior crew chief of the SP2C, Hell Diver.
Fantastic. We'll look forward to that coming up. We're also expecting a new segment to come in from Dan Webb and Tom, and we'll insert that into the podcast later. We've also got David's This Week in Aviation and the Australia Desk Report from Steve and Grant. So let's jump right away into the aviation news. Our first story comes from Arrived OK. This is titled The Future of Airliners. There is a professor of aerospace engineering named Ian Pohl. He's from Cranfield University and head of technology for the government-funded Omega project. Now, Mr. Pohl believes that later in this century, nuclear-powered aircraft will be transporting millions of passengers around the world. He believes that one of the benefits of such nuclear-powered aircraft is no carbon emissions, and he has a plan for how the reactors could be safely shielded from the passengers, and that would be to attach them out on the ends of the wings. Now, I have to say, I think a nuclear-powered airliner seems a little far-fetched.
But Max, it's not.
I don't think it's far-fetched. Mind glowing people, I mean, but...
yeah, glowing-in-the-dark passengers.
And believe it or not, they flew a B-36 with a nuclear reactor in the 50s.
Yeah, there was some research back in the height of the Cold War period, driven by the desire, I think, to keep bombers flying all the time. Both Pratt & Whitney and General Electric were working on nuclear engine projects, but both were eventually scrapped.
Well, we have this slight place called Three Mile Island around where I live.
Yes.
And I think that pretty much killed any idea that, I mean, what happens when a nuclear-powered airplane goes down in, like the Airbus did in Lower Manhattan, that was an accident? I don't really think this is probably a really good idea.
It doesn't seem very feasible to me. This guy suggests that, you know, one way to try to prevent the problem of the plane going down and the reactors, you know, crashing into the ground would be to attach parachutes to them so that they could be ejected from the aircraft as it went down. But, you know, I find it hard to believe that, you know, that's a process that would actually work in the middle of an impending accident.
Let's see. And of course, what could happen is that as the nuclear core is ejected, which of course happens all the time on Star Trek.
Yes.
You are such a geek.
I know. You'd have to decide which neighborhood was the low man on the totem pole in order to receive the spent nuclear core.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that would work out. But actually, too, when you think about it, I mean, you're an engine guy, Max. I mean,
right.
I mean, nuclear reactors basically heat water to turn it into steam to turn steam turbines. And I don't know that I've ever heard of a steam turbine kind of propulsion system. I mean, I'm maybe I'm, you know, not an injured guy, but it just sounds a little impractical in this day and age.
Well, I think so. And I do know that when Pratt and GE were developing designs in the past, they were two different strategies. One was to use the reactor to heat air and then compressed air and then pass that through the turbine to generate the thrust. And the other approach was to use the reactor to heat liquid metal, which I don't know, maybe that was sodium or something like that, and I think the molten metal to heat the air to then pass that through the turbine. So there were two different approaches. You know, I'm not sure, David, which of those two or some other technique was used for that one aircraft that did fly. Are you aware?
The Convair B-36 actually generated electricity for the aircraft, but actually wasn't flown using nuclear power. They flew it with a nuclear reactor on it, and it generated power for the aircraft, but the main thrust were the standard jet engine, J-47s,
right,
and the six big turbo, the reciprocal engine. So needless to say, the moment it started taking off, there were people on the ground screaming, "It better not fly over my house."
Yeah, exactly. And this story sort of follows on the heels of some of the things we talked about last episode with respect to looking into the future and trying to predict, you know, what kinds of aircraft we might see in the future. But I think if I'm just skeptical that this is ever going to see the light of day or the investment of a dollar, maybe. Okay, our next story comes from Como News. Boeing apologizes for curt letter sent to young boy. Well, there's an 8-year-old from Colorado. His name is Harry, and Harry likes airplanes. In fact, Harry likes to draw airplanes. And Harry is always drawing airplanes, so he decided that he would send some of his ideas to Boeing and to see what happened. Well, what happened was Boeing sent him back a form letter. And this explained that they have a corporate policy that prohibits them from accepting outside ideas. Harry's father was, as well as Harry, I'm sure, was a little bit disappointed with this response. It seems like kind of a little bit of maybe corporate insensitivity, and probably could have been handled a little bit better, at least on the first pass.
A little bit of corporate insensitivity?
Yeah.
And how do you really feel, Rob?
I think this is corporate stupidity.
Now, I can see them having a policy that prevents unsolicited ideas from getting into their system. But, you know, when a kid sends in some drawings of an airplane, I think you should think about encouraging the child, and rather than just, you know, putting him off the way they did.
Well, you know, I'd be very curious to know who he sent them to at Boeing, because if they went to, say, the corporate communications department, there might have been a better chance of someone realizing that, come on, it's a kid. He took the time to draw these photos, send them a Boeing model or something.
Right, exactly.
As opposed to if it had been a finance person who said, no, the rule is that we don't take that. Send them a form letter. There are just people that just don't get that at all.
I think what Boeing just did was create a really good, innovative engineer for either Embraer or Bombardier or Airbus in the future, because that kid is never going to draw, talk, or speak about a Boeing aircraft again.
Yeah, remember United Breaks Guitars? This is called Boeing Doesn't Build Airplanes Very Well Anymore. Yeah. Oh, that's right. They are having trouble, aren't they? Oh,
a little.
What a coincidence.
Well, I guess Boeing did come to see the error of their ways. A Boeing spokesperson, Todd Belcher, was later quoted as saying, "We should be taking the opportunity with a child to encourage their interest in airplanes. And so we're going to try and come up with a better letter for children that meets our legal needs, but also has more positive words for them." Still sounds a little cold, but...
Did he have to throw in that meets our legal needs?
Yeah, that's the cold part.
I mean, it's like, okay, what you're saying is, never mind. Next story.
Corporate speak.
Yeah, exactly. All right, this comes from carrentals.co.uk. SkyWest Airlines flight diverted after alien claim. Well, SkyWest Airlines flight from Helena to Salt Lake City had to be diverted after a particular passenger started banging on the door of the cockpit, claiming that he was an alien and that he wanted to fly the airplane.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate the flight wasn't headed to Roswell.
Yeah, that would have been perfect.
We're not talking about somebody that was coming from south of the border, kind of alien. We're talking about
from outer space. That's right.
Well, no, I don't think that. I don't think Arizona was mentioned at all as far as aliens. Okay. So I think you're off the hook.
Just want to be clear on that.
So do you think the TSA is now, as a result of this, is going to try to develop some kind of screening for aliens that...
Well, I wish I'd known. When did this story come out? I didn't see this one before.
It was at the beginning of May.
Oh, gosh, because you know what? I was having a conversation with, of all people yesterday, Chip Childs, who's the CEO of SkyWest up at the RAA convention. I would have loved to have asked him this question about the alien.
Well, apparently this passenger ended up getting subdued. One of the stewards yelled for help from the passengers, and as it described in this article, a big cowboy grabbed our little alien here and subdued him. It turned out that this big cowboy named Clay Cooper is a 7-time professional rodeo world champion.
I'm sorry, the image of a lasso coming out and roping him into his chair is just...
Yeah, but you know, you have to be really careful with that because you know what you get if you get a cowboy trying to do something like that on an airplane, don't you? You can have a lasso lawsuit. You don't want one of those. Those are bad.
No. Okay. Why? Because he might have possibly stepped in it?
Oh, God. Is this going to be a short show tonight, Max? I don't know if I can take much of this.
I know.
Or is it going to be the other passengers were cowing in the corner?
Yeah. Well, I guess the lesson in all this is if you're an alien and you're trying to overtake an aircraft, just make sure that there's no big cowboys who are professional rodeo champions because your attempt will be unsuccessful.
Way to go, Clay.
Yeah, nice job. All right, we've got an item from CNET News. This is a viewing deck built right into your private jet. BAE Systems Air Deck is a balcony that folds down right out of the side of a private jet. And this was a design that a company called Design Q came up with. And I guess this is for BAE's Explorer 1 and Explorer 4 Avro business jets. What this reminds me of, you know those campers that have sort of...
Pop-outs.
Now, this is kind of like a patio that pops out of the rear side of the airplane. I don't know, Rob, do you think there's much of a demand for this sort of thing?
Well, I guess the only thing I would wonder is that when that thing pops out of the side of the airplane, how do the people hang on?
It's on the ground.
Oh! It only comes out on the ground. I see.
Well, okay. I assume that at least from the illustrations in the article, which show a elegantly furnished private jet with this balcony and some chairs and a table, and it looks like it's sort of looking out over the African savanna. Now, I don't know how many people park their private jets in the middle of the African savanna.
Max, you're missing the point.
Okay.
This is the ultimate airplane for tailgating at air shows. You fly it into Oshkosh, you park it on the end of the runway, you pop open the thing, fire up the grill, and next thing you know, you can be podcasting from your British Aerospace aircraft in the middle of an air show. When you're done, you fold it all up and you fly home.
Now, suddenly I'm much more enthusiastic about this idea.
You are. Okay.
Because short of that, I don't know where you'd park the thing where you'd want to sit. I mean, at the airport, what are you going to do, sit out there on the tarmac on your deck? I don't think so. I think if you have an airplane like this, you're going to be in the poolside at the 5-star hotel.
The next step would be the other side pop-out will be the built-in hot tub, Max.
There you go.
I mean, if a limousine can have a hot tub, there's no reason why we can't just do this to,
Yeah, absolutely.
Or there'll be a new global bachelor party thing. Instead of renting a limo for the weekend, you rent this thing and go somewhere.
Well, speaking of parties on airplanes, our next article comes from blackbook.com. This is new Lufthansa bathrooms made for banging. Last week, we talked about Lufthansa taking delivery of their new Airbus A380. This is an article about the bathroom in the first class cabin. Now, this is a fairly elegant looking little room. It looks like a room, but one of the things it features is a sort of long cushioned leather bench like seat. And so the speculation here is, what would be the use for that kind of a seat?
They put a bench in the A380?
That's
right. In the bathroom.
In the bathroom. You know, sort of a long, comfy bench that might be enough room.
Okay. So let's just set that up again. So pretend you asked me again, and I'll...
First, Rob, look at the chat and look at the bottom link.
Wait, hang on. I'm good at the chat. Where's the chat?
You're getting there. Okay.
Hang on. Wait, there's the chat. Okay. The Black Book Mag right thing. All right. Come on. Here we go. Let's see. Loading the new Lufthansa bathroom. Okay. Oh yes. My God, it looks like a sauna in there, sort of. Okay.
It does.
All right. I'm ready. I'm set.
Okay. So this
now, you see the bench located on the right side of the picture?
Yeah, it's not where that little man is standing on the wall, right? The little figure.
No, that would be a flight. That would be a carry on.
I see. Okay.
That's not a person.
I'm ready. Oh, wow. Look at that. Actually, you know what this reminds me of? The first time I wandered into a woman's bathroom by mistake.
And I was wondering
why the women's bathrooms had those long couches and things in them. So women can sit down and
rest. And...
Well, but guys go into the bathroom with a purpose.
Get her done.
We don't rest.
Yeah. I mean, and why would you want to sit around? So I can tell this is not a bathroom a man would use.
Well, I got a question for you. Is there somebody outside? I mean, will there be term limits for using this? Like you put the money in the door and you have a half hour of it before the flight attendant comes knocking on it? Because the way this is set up, you could get lost in this bathroom.
It's rather amazing.
There are certainly some opportunities to accomplish some amazing things in a room that large.
As you always say, Rob, you know, let's be serious now. How many people actually get lucky in an airplane?
I don't know. The movies I watch, it always happens.
Yeah, but...
See, if we had Dan here, we could ask, find out how much does it actually cost to fly a Lufthansa A380 first class, because I don't think the $5,000 price tag to get the opportunity to visit this bathroom may really be worth it.
Yeah, that's
probably a good point.
All right, that's probably enough of that one.
So new Lufthansa bathrooms made for banging, and I'm assuming that when they used that term, what did you think that they meant?
Well, I thought it was pretty. I thought it was pretty obvious.
There's a gong that you don't see at the end of the bathroom. You just ring it.
Right. You know, okay.
Bang
that's
it.
What I.
Oh, that must be it. Sure.
Okay.
Next story comes from AOL Travel. Get angry and TSA may tag you. Now, this is about air travelers who, I guess, threaten airport security folks. If you do that, you can end up in the Homeland Security database. You know, maybe we're all already in the TSA database, given the comments we've made about the TSA in the past.
No. We know TSA
Bob.
We know TSA Bob, and Bob promised that he would save us from anything.
But that was a long time ago. We talked to Blogger Bob. I wonder if he still remembers us.
We need to talk to Blogger Bob again, maybe.
We may have to refresh our relationship.
I think we could have Blogger Bob on to respond to this. Is there a blacklist?
So what happens if you're on the blacklist and you show up?
you get angry and therefore get secondary screening and get angrier. So you get further on the blacklist and thus the vicious cycle spirals out of control.
Now, this is a blacklist for people who are viewed as sort of a threat.
She added that employees who encounter a threat from a passenger or otherwise see a display of violent behavior can make a complaint. And, quote, after the facts are gathered, unquote, incident reports are tracked to identify repeat offenders.
Oh, so this is like a database of the rude people.
I'm definitely in there, I'm sure.
You must be in there, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, I'm known for going into those places and saying things like, why is this line moving so slowly? I'm in the wrong
line.
Well,
that'll get you flagged every time.
Yeah, I mean, that's right, because that sounds very commonsensical, doesn't it? That can't be right.
Yeah. All right, shall we try another serious story from the Wichita Eagle?
Another serious story? You mean that last one was serious?
It was kind of serious. Well, okay.
Okay.
This one is definitely serious.
Okay.
More pilots needed, AOPA president tells Aero Club.
Oh, that sounds like a Molly story. That's Molly Milliken.
Yeah, well, she says that Bruce Landsberg, who's the president of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association Foundation, says that the number of pilots in the USA is declining and that this is a real big concern. Now, there's some statistics, there's some numbers in here that I thought were very interesting. It says the U.S. pilot population in 1980 was 827,000 pilots. That seems like a pretty big number to me. That's a lot of pilots.
Yeah.
That's in 1980. Well, if you look at today, there's fewer than 600,000 pilots. That's a huge drop in the number of pilots.
Yeah, and it's getting worse. I mean, I think what's interesting is that, you know, before the economy tanked, the airlines were, well, everybody was seeing a horrible pilot shortage. There just were not enough bodies around to make it all work.
Yeah.
I mean, that they say is related to that horrible crash out in Buffalo, you know, winter before last. But I mean, and only because the economy tanked and service was being pulled and slowed that we have not experienced another pilot shortage. But when things ramp up again, it's going to happen. And the big problem is that we're not filling in the bottom end. We're not, you know, there are pilots with experience out there, but we're not finding the new people to keep climbing the ladder. And that's going to be a problem a few years down the line.
Historically, think about it. When was the first dates, Max?
That was 827,000 in 1980.
Well, that would be either very late World War II pilots included, Korean pilots, Vietnam War pilots.
Yeah, sure.
We had a huge military component back then too that were filtering into World War II alone, we had 100,000 pilots, you know, set up. So that was going to shrink because we had no reason to train that many pilots. I mean, so there's some natural, I agree with Rob that there is way too much shrinkage, but there was going to be some natural shrinkage because we were training pilots for military organizations.
Yeah,
now it's almost impossible to get a slot in the Air Force for a pilot school.
Well, another thing that this article brings out is something that I think, Rob, you mentioned previously in a previous episode. It says that only about 20% of those who begin to learn to fly become pilots. They start, but don't finish.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's really the crime of this whole thing. I mean, I've been whining for years about the fact that...
Jet whining?
I was...
Shameless self-promotion, folks.
In fact, it's really funny. When I was at the RAA convention the other day, I got up to talk to the social media crowd, and I basically told them who I was, and I got a tweet a few minutes later from some guy who I don't even know that said, "You know what? Knock off all the self promotion, buddy." I thought, "Whoa!" You know, I don't even know where the guy was and how he heard me, but maybe it's the same guy we were talking about before the show started. I don't know. But it is a shame that the flight schools and flight instructors and all that don't take the time to follow up with students that tend to want to drop out. And it's because they've been so busy with more students they could handle that they just really didn't care. And that you see that with tradespeople. You know, try and complain about a plumber. They don't care. They say, "Hey, we don't. There are 50 more people behind you."
Mm.
Except that our industry is at a point now where we can't afford that anymore. And a lot of the flight schools really just do not know what to do with that problem.
Mm.
They've just never had that kind of training. A lot of them are not. They don't have a strong marketing focus. They really don't know what to do. But it's really going to come back to haunt us, I think, here big time. And I think that's really the crime, is that not how few people are starting, but how few people are finishing.
Yeah, and Landsberg has some thoughts on that.
Oh, he does. In fact, we're going to have Bruce Landsberg on the show here in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, and that'll be great. We'll have to talk to him about this.
That's going to be one of his topics, actually.
Okay, great. So, Rob, any comments from the convention that you were just at, the regional aircraft?
Regional Airline Association.
Regional Airline Association. Anything come from that?
Well, let's see. I think the best part of the entire convention was the social media piece that they had at lunch yesterday. In fact, I think that might be because all the people that were on the social media panel as social media geeks and geekettes were people we've had on our show long ago.
So yes.
Yeah.
We had Benet Wilson was there, Mary Kirby, and Brett Snyder, better known as Cranky Flyer.
Right.
And he didn't seem real cranky to me.
He's basically a nice guy.
No, he's a real nice guy, actually. You know, I wish people would stop saying this. I'm not really cranky. And I said, I know, I'm just blank leg. So, but what I always think is interesting is that we heard people saying things like, well, we don't have time for all this social media stuff. We have real work to do. And the people talking on Twitter and Facebook, who cares about all that junk? And what they sort of don't realize is that that's kind of the way the world is headed in terms of how people are going to make buying decisions about all sorts of things. Hmm. And so it's going to need a little time to sink into some people, I guess. But anyway, yeah. Mary Kirby, for those of you that are wondering, Mary Kirby is a rather tallish redhead, and Brett is kind of a shorter than Mary guy. And Benet's a shorter than Mary lady, and I'm in with both of those guys. I'm shorter. Actually, everybody's shorter than Mary.
Everyone is.
It's not a bad thing. Mary brought her love with her this time. So, hey, shout out to Dave. Dave, good. I better not say anything.
Yeah. Let's leave it at that.
Cut that part out there, baby.
So, were there any overall themes from the conference that are interesting? Or
you know, I they talked about safety. They talked about the future of the air traffic control system. But the one thing that I personally just didn't care for at the RAA convention was that so many of the sessions that I think really would have been sort of newsy were completely locked out to the general public and the media. So we had no idea what was going on. So I'm sure there may have been more news there, but we just couldn't hear it.
Yeah, it's too bad.
Yeah. But it was in Milwaukee, I mean, where there were lots of brats, and we went to a German restaurant. They took the media out for dinner on Monday night, and we went to a German restaurant with German beer and a man in Lederhosen playing the accordion, and he had one of those little leather caps with feathers in it. It looked like he had fish lures hanging from it or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't know, whatever they put on him. So that was kind of cool.
All right. Very good. Well, as we mentioned at the start, Dan wasn't able to join us as we were recording the news, but he did send in a report. And
Dan hasn't been here?
Dan hasn't been. You just thought he was being very quiet, huh?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
All right. That's a virtual impossibility.
That's true. That's very true. Here's Dan's report.
Hello, everyone. This is Dan here. Unfortunately, yet characteristically, I was unable to make the early recording session to put episode 99 in the books. However, I still wanted to record a brief segment with some airline news. Obviously, just having me would be really, really boring. So I do have a guest with me today. I have Tom from the airline blog. Tom was a guest with us back for episode number 59 in August of last year. Tom's a college student like me, just finished his sophomore. He's been blogging for a few years, so it's really great to welcome back to the podcast. So, Tom, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
So, Tom and I were going to go over a few stories, and actually a good number of them actually have an international focus. And I know there have been some listeners over the past few months that have said, you know, can we have some more European stories? So here they are. Hopefully you enjoy them. So let's just get right to it. You ready, Tom?
Yep.
Okay, first story, requisite paper crumbling to sound legitimate that we actually have newspapers. So our first story comes from an idiot blogger named Dan Webb with a blog post entitled Continental Announces First 787 Route. This is actually a Continental announcement, but I think it's important, even though the merger hasn't been approved, to start looking at Continental and United as one carrier. They were the first airline to announce an actual schedule for one of their 787 aircraft. So the new route, starting November 16th, 2011, goes from Houston to Auckland, New Zealand. Daily service during most of the year, but five times weekly service during some of the low points of the season. But so definitely an exciting announcement. Definitely a far out announcement, but actually there is an interesting piece in Aviation Week by Adrian Schofield, a very interesting blog post. And he was saying there are some interesting motives. Actually, this route was announced the day before Continental CEO Jeff Smizik and United CEO Glenn Tilton would be testifying at the Hill. Actually, one of their Senate panel meetings was canceled, but the two CEOs did testify to the Senate Antitrust Committee. So still some interesting timing there, Tom. I'm not sure what you think.
Yeah, no, I think definitely that this announcement right now has been timed to kind of say, well, look, these are the benefits that we can derive from this merger, and that if this thing can go through, then we'll be able to start service and obviously get some traffic on both ends, connecting in Auckland and connecting in Houston.
Yeah, and obviously, just from the political angle, I'm not surprised that if some Texan political leaders are a bit concerned about this merge entities, especially since the merged airline will be based in Chicago. So what does that mean for Houston specifically? And because since Continental is such a huge employer there.
Well, I think that Glenn Tilton, actually, he himself has some Houston experience, right? He used to
yes.
be a senior executive over at Texaco based in Houston. So I think he's definitely trying to use that to his advantage right now. And I think United is the new combined United and Continental will definitely keep significant operations in Houston. So in terms of the local economic impact, there will be some in terms of senior management going to Chicago, but I don't think Houston should be hurt too much by this.
Yeah, I think just from a network perspective, I definitely do not think that Houston is a hub that's really at a great risk to be cut. I think actually it would be the largest hub with the new United. I'm not positive on that, but if there's any continental hub that should be concerned right now, I think it's Cleveland. But I think there really are some perks here. I think, Tom, you mentioned there are some good connecting flows. It's a hub-to-hub route for Star Alliance with Air New Zealand. It also makes some connections easier. Actually, as the crow flies, actually some connections to the U.S. are shorter via Houston instead of Los Angeles, which is right now where the only nonstop to the U.S. is. So, and actually, another thing I noticed, let's say I'm flying to or from New York, if I only want one connection – right now, I have to fly out of New York JFK. Through right. Houston, you can fly out of LaGuardia.
Gives you more options, certainly.
And the other thing, I think this is the exact kind of route that the 787 was built for.
Oh, definitely, yes.
Long and thin is basically been the phrase I'm seeing a lot, because this is a route, you know, that can be flown with existing aircraft. If they're in New Zealand, they have some new 777-300ERs on the way. If they wanted to, they could fly that route with this aircraft. But about 110 seats larger than the 787 as Continental will configure it. So yeah, I think this is a very interesting move.
No, definitely. And I think the 787 is, this is one of those routes that this plane was made for. It's very well suited for the task. And I think Continental will be able to fill a lot of seats up, probably less with point-to-point traffic, but also, as we've mentioned, a lot of connecting traffic on both ends.
And I think it's a preview of coming attractions. You know, we could see some new routes that don't make economic sense anymore. But also a 787 could be a replacement of a let's say there's an underperforming route that right now Continental can only fly up on their 777s. Well, now you can throw a 787 on it. And another interesting thing I'd like to point out is right now both Continental and United have 787-8 orders. And Continental has some orders for the Dash 9 as well. So if these airlines are able to merge, United would be able to have 787s to play with much sooner, with Continental's coming next year and United's coming a few years down the pike. But now just to move to the other big ocean on the other side of our wonderful continent, the Atlantic, we have another story from a very horrible blog called the Airline Blog, with a post entitled and the post title is a question: the end of Virgin Atlantic's splendid isolation? Tom, what did he write?
Question mark. The end of Virgin Atlantic's splendid isolation. That is correct. Basically, Richard Branson, we all know and love, I guess, or maybe don't love, depending upon his rather outlandish statements sometimes.
I think if you're British Airways, I'm not sure if the feeling is love. Well, more specifically, if you're One World.
He's been in the news recently, and he has, Virgin Atlantic has remained fiercely independent for its entire existence, no alliances. I mean, it has done code shares, but nothing too serious. And he's made an interesting comment this past week when he said, quote, if it becomes impossible for us to remain an independent airline and survive, we may come to a situation where we have to consolidate, end quote. And so I think this is the first time, really, that, you know, if I'm not mistaken, that Branson is publicly acknowledging that the British Airways American Airlines tie-up, which has been in the works for, I'd say, over a decade now, is pretty much inevitable at this point. And so he's certainly getting a little scared that just the size and just power, I guess, of this combined British Airways American, well, not combined, but a much deeper tie between British Airways and American, as well as the merger that's going on between British Airways and Iberia, might start to put the squeeze on him. So now that he's mentioned, obviously, the whole idea of a merger, the question is, well, with whom would Virgin Atlantic merge? And one of the possibilities that he himself has mentioned is British Midland, also known as BMI. He said, quote, I don't think BMI has a future as a standalone airline if it stays in the same shape. Something will happen. The two of us would be stronger together than separate. And certainly the two airlines do have much in common in the form of a shared enemy at Heathrow, which is British Airways. On the surface, I think it seems to be a good match, and this is why Branson and a lot of other people have kind of pointed to BMI as being the ideal merger partner for Virgin. But I think if you look a little closer at the proposed combination, things start to get a little more complicated. One of the main reasons is the fact that Lufthansa now owns BMI outright. And is in the process of restructuring it and shifting kind of the short-haul European routes around between BMI and Lufthansa and other Lufthansa-owned carriers such as Swiss and Brussels Airlines and so on.
Yeah, and I believe actually there was an article I saw a while ago that here's a headline from the Daily Mail. This is all back in November. Heathrow sales throw BMI a lifeline. Troubled airline BMI has secured a vital financial lifeline that could help it remain in business after selling 6 slot pairs of takeoff and landing slots at Heathrow to Swiss International Airlines around £60 million. That's a great asset for the Lufthansa Group right there.
Oh yeah, no, those slots at Heathrow are definitely gold, and every airline there knows that, BMI included, and so if they're facing a situation where they need to raise some quick cash, they can sell off those slots. But now that Lufthansa, either directly or indirectly through its airline subsidiaries, owns a pretty good chunk of slots at London Heathrow. The only problem now is, though, is that Lufthansa certainly has its reasons for restructuring BMI the way that it does, and obviously it has certain goals in mind for itself and its subsidiary airlines. But the restructuring process certainly makes BMI less attractive from a merger standpoint. So Virgin Atlantic is a lot like Singapore or Emirates in the sense that they don't fly any short-haul routes. They're exclusively long-haul. And so BMI would then therefore seem to be a pretty good fit because BMI has very few longer-range routes of its own and primarily concentrates on inter-European routes. The only problem is that out of Heathrow, which is where a good percentage of Virgin Atlantic's long-haul flying is based, out of Heathrow, BMI only has service to a select number of European destinations, and so certainly it would make BMI look a lot less attractive in terms of a complementary route structure where BMI's short haul and Virgin Atlantic's long haul would be able to combine together.
Yeah, and I mean it's been interesting how Lufthansa does play with BMI. They've put BMI on some new routes to Germany. I believe Vienna is a new route for BMI, and that's done in conjunction with Austrian. So really, I think actually a couple of BMI aircraft might be operating for Lufthansa right now. I'm not sure about that right now, but
yes, I've heard that that is
basically BMI has become an interesting part of the Lufthansa group. But you know, while the network might not be as attractive as it used to be, still, I think a lot of it is the Heathrow slots. One argument that Branson has made for a long time is that okay, Frankfurt and Paris, yes, there are other big hubs controlled by a dominant alliance. But those airports aren't full. He's saying mm-hmm. that it's very hard to get slots, period. So still having access to the slots reinvigorate the network. And I think it'd also be a good fit because Virgin and BMI do already do some code sharing. So
yes, they do. So according to BMI, its EU destinations from London Heathrow are 5 destinations within the UK, as well as outside of the UK, we've got Dublin, Berlin, Hanover, and Vienna. And in my opinion, certainly, you know, this does not comprise a solid feeder operation at London Heathrow that Virgin Atlantic could use to kind of feed into its long haul routes. Certainly, British Midland does have quite a bit of code share capability with its airline partners at London Heathrow. You know, but I'm pretty sure that the operating carrier in that case, which could be Brussels, which could be Lufthansa or so on, would keep the lion's share of the profits or the revenues from the flight. So in that sense, certainly it does not make BMI as attractive. Although, as you mentioned, however, BMI does have one thing that a lot of airlines would gladly like, and that is slots at Heathrow, of course.
Yeah. Well, but the other thing is, in addition to those routes, there are some interesting routes that I believe are branded as Lufthansa, operated by BMI. So I believe to Cologne and Dresden and a couple other cities. So it's interesting how it's not just BMI, it's just sort of Lufthansa. So it's an interesting branding discussion as well.
Yes, and I think, right now it really kind of begs the question, well, what does Lufthansa have brand-wise, you know, in store for BMI in the long term? Are they going to continue to use it, this thing where, you know, say if you fly from London Heathrow to, one of the cities that you mentioned, where you have a British Midland aircraft, British Midland staff, but, you know, other aspects, for example, perhaps the food maybe, you know, served on board are branded as Lufthansa, then you kind of have this weird situation going on where no one can say for sure, really, I guess, what airline you're flying on.
Okay, so our third story, it's a very short blog from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Headline report, Air France-KLM to restart talks for big plane order. And this comes actually from a report from a French newspaper. But according to always the unnamed source, we could be seeing an order next year. And with the group looking at the 787-9, the A350-900 to replace some A330s and A340s, as well as some 777s and some MD-11s. So now, Tom, actually, you found some interesting things with the original French article.
Something that the Seattle PI did not mention, I think, was, and the French article, I believe, did, was that the 747-400 that's operated by Air France is also a candidate for retirement. They also mentioned in the French article that the 777-300s were out for retirement, and that the oldest of those that Air France operated was 10 years. But as we know, the 777-300 entered service with Air France in 2004, so those are only 6 years old, so hardly long in the tooth, I think, by any standard.
Now, it's interesting that I mentioned that the 747 is mentioned there, because I think a lot of us were under the assumption that the A380 would be the direct replacement there. If you look at right now, I think the airline has 12 of those. I think eventually Air France will have 12 A380s, but then again, it's also 100 seats bigger. So, but actually, when you look at the list of some aircraft looking to be replaced, especially like names like the A340, you might think, well, these are pretty modern aircraft. But Air France was actually a launch customer for the A340. They have some of the oldest out there, introduced in 1993. So, you know, soon to be pushing 20 years.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, those A340s are certainly you can't really find that many older A340s than the ones that Air France operates. And I'm not familiar actually with the age of KLM's MD-11s, but I know that they've been trying to seek a replacement for those for quite some time now.
Yeah, and they have put some new life into those. I think they got new interiors a while back, but those are pushing about 15. Years is an average age, and actually it'll be kind of sad when those eventually get retired, because that'll be the last major passenger operator of the type, but neither here nor there. So it is interesting, as we said, the article isn't perfect. There are, like, I'm not sure, does Air France really need an A330 replacement right now with the A330-200 coming in 2001, but I guess deliveries would be coming, you know, a few years from now, and I we're still not in a great economic environment, I'm sure.
Right. If the order comes in 2011, like the article says, it could still be several years after that. I'm not really familiar with the, you know, order delivery timelines, but we could be looking at a situation where, you know, Air France is not, and KLM are not taking delivery of new aircraft for, say, another 10 years, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, and we'll see how long it goes. But like when United announced their order for the A350, in the 787, you'll see aircraft coming between 2016 and 2019, when the fleet will be even older. So first, I think it's
a lot of speculation at this point.
Yeah, but I mean, now probably just timing-wise, I think it's still a good time to buy aircraft. But another important aspect of this order is now that you have a customer ordering not as Air France and KLM separately, but as the Air France KLM group, when they have that additional bargaining power, you probably have more sway with the manufacturers, and especially in the case where with both airlines operating good sized fleets from both manufacturers, obviously Boeing and Airbus want to hold on to those customers. So I think the group is in a good place right now when it comes to ordering.
Yeah, no, they certainly, you know, by keeping their fleet split between the two manufacturers, they can, you know, Air France KLM can certainly play Boeing and Airbus off of each other for the better deal, as we've seen United do recently, for example.
One last quick story. Here's a Ryanair press release with the headline, Barcelona El Prat announced as Ryanair's 42nd base.
Second, wow.
Yes. And I just found this story very interesting because Ryanair, a la Southwest, has served Barcelona with alternate airports, Reus, not sure if I'm saying that right, and then Girona being the bigger one. Not that Ryanair has shied away from big airports. I think Madrid is a big example that they will go into larger airports. But for Barcelona, they're willing to go into the big airport now. So I found that interesting. And I'd be interested to see how many passengers were driving to these alternate airports and then I'll go to Barcelona. Of course, we did see some interesting claims from Ryanair just to brag about their new service to Barcelona, basically saying that the airport really has a low fares presence. I'm going to guess that they're just gleefully ignoring Air Berlin, EasyJet, Vueling.
Conveniently forgetting those, yes, as my theory is sometimes.
German Wings, a few others, so. Yeah, but whatever. We love Michael O'Leary over here.
An interesting point that you made on your article, Dan, actually, was that that Ryanair is not yet competing on the Barcelona-Madrid route, which is certainly one of the more traveled ones throughout the world. But the number of passengers flying has seen a downturn ever since they've started up rail line, actually. So it'd be interesting to see how that works out versus Ryanair and whether Ryanair will be able to undercut the train, I guess.
Well, yeah, and then that's what another interesting claim I found in the press release with saying, okay, we're going to reverse the trend for the decline in passengers. And of course, you know, Barcelona, like pretty much every other city on the planet, has seen a decrease in passengers, partially because of the recession, but there's also been a decrease on this route, which is one of the busiest in the world because of a new high-speed rail line. So if Ryanair isn't going to be on that route, I'm not sure exactly how they can turn that around. But nevertheless, still interesting. They're estimating about 2 million passengers per year. That'll all be interesting to see. And also, I think it's good from a competitive standpoint because we have seen some consolidation in the industry. You did have a couple Spanish LCCs, Click Air, whose livery I still miss dearly, and Vueling. But those two carriers have merged, and actually Iberia has a 45% stake in the merged airline. So we've definitely seen some consolidation there in the Spanish market. So I'd have to assume that from a consumer standpoint, you know, new competition is good.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's interesting now to see how just, this is a little bit off topic, but just how big Ryanair is. They're opening up their 42nd base. They have well over 1,000 routes across Europe. Never mind how many they, you know, serve with some amount of regularity, but, you know, they're just huge right now.
All right, anyway, I think we've gone pretty long as is, so I think it's a good time to end the segment. So, Tom, thank you very much for joining me, and where can people find you on
the internet? My pleasure. People can find me online at The Airline Blog, all one word, theairlineblog.blogspot.com.
And are you on Twitter as well?
And oh, yes. I am also on Twitter as well, at Airline Blog.
Okay, cool. As always, I am Dan Webb. You can find my blog at thingsinthesky.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Webbage. I will be back with everyone, hopefully, for the big episode 100. I can't wait. So we'll catch you guys next week.
As we mentioned at the start, David attended the Joint Service Open House this year, and he went armed with his digital recorder. And not being the shy type when it comes to great aircraft, David apparently marched right up and snagged some short interviews with a number of folks at that event.
For years, I've been going to Andrews since I was old enough to drive. After 9/11, you are not allowed to park on the base. They have shuttle parking, but which means you go to FedEx Field. For all those American football fans, that would be where the Washington Redskins play. They take you through security very quickly. And then Andrews does something that no other air show does. They have buses, and they have buses, and then they have more buses. And that's followed by some more buses. I think when I was waiting for my bus, the whole five-minute wait, there was approximately 35 to 40 full-size school buses and commuter buses waiting to take people to the air show.
Jeez.
So they do the whole busing to the offsite. It's probably one of the most joyful experiences getting off and on the base now, because you don't ever wait in traffic when you get back, because at FedEx Field you've got multiple exit points and you're not trying to go through one single gate like if you've ever driven a U.S. air show. Mm-hmm. It can be quite difficult. You add another 2 to 3 hours at the end of your show.
Yeah, absolutely.
The featured performers were the Blue Angels. The Joint Service Open House, Andrews, has the advantage of having every service provide static displays and demonstration aircraft. So you have, of course, the United States Air Force, and they provided the F-22 Raptor and an F-16 for their demos, as well as one of my favorites, the C-17. I love the fact that it's a static display aircraft. You back it out, and then you take it off, fly it, and then you bring it back to static display for people to go through. The Navy had the F-18F Super Hornet. They had multiple aircraft on display. The Army had a series of Army helicopters, as well as they usually have a full set of armament equipment, Tang M1s and Pershings and all sorts of that kind of interesting stuff. The U.S. Border and Customs Service actually had a very large display this year, surprisingly, from a P-3 to a Citation jet to a pair of helicopters, UH-1D, and that was next to the U.S. Coast Guard display, which had a couple of helicopters, as well as a C, I don't know what it is, but it's an Italian transport. And last but not least, we have the Marines. I got to see a Harrier demo, which I haven't seen in quite a long time.
Yeah, cool.
There is something to be said for watching that thing just sit there and hover.
Yes.
But what you're about to hear is I try to get a smattering of everything. Andrews suddenly has developed this huge warbird following. So on the flight line, besides all the modern military hardware, we had a Corsair, a P-47, the world's only SB-2C hell diver that flies. Hmm. There were a pair of C-47s, a pair of B-17s, as well as a Spitfire, a P-40. It was a really good warbird show, and
yeah,
people
cool.
seemed very friendly. And so I was taking my little Sony mic and shoving it in people's faces. So, Max, why don't you roll the tape, and hopefully everyone will enjoy listening to this. For all those people out there, there's even a fan that shows up on the recording.
This is your Joint Service Open House correspondent, David Vanderhoof, and I'm sitting right now under the wing of a P-47D, Jackie's Revenge, and I'm sitting next to the pilot, Jim Vercel, of the American Air Power Museum. Jim, what's it like to fly the airplane we're sitting behind?
Well, it's certainly an awesome airplane to fly. Anytime you can fly a piece of history, it is really, truly an enormous thrill for me to do that and to bring it to air shows and show it to the people and to tell the folks, educate them on what this airplane did during World War II. Now, this particular airplane, this P-47D, is certainly the heaviest fighter ever built by Republic, which is located in Farmingdale, Long Island, New York, which is where the American Air Power Museum is located. The airplane is a little heavy on the controls, although very, very smooth flying airplane. It has a short wing, so you have to be cognizant of your speed all the time. And it is, like I said, it is the heaviest fighter ever produced during World War II.
And what's the specific history of the aircraft? Is it...
Unfortunately, I don't have the specific. I know it came from Yugoslavia and then went to California to be rebuilt, and we purchased it from a museum in California about 10 years ago.
And how long have you been flying her?
I've been flying her about 10 years.
And you can't get enough of it, can you?
You can't. I'm privileged to do this and to talk with folks about what this airplane did during World War II. Yes, you're right. I can't get enough of it.
What other flying do you do?
I also fly, I used to fly for the airlines. I was 767 captain for a major airline here, and since retired, and now I'm just flying warbirds for different museums, mostly the American Air Power Museum currently.
And what else do you have sick time on?
Oh, I have sick time. The list is endless. It starts with the T-6, the Grumman Avenger, the P-40, the P-47, the Corsair. I've flown the B-17, the B-24, the B-25, the C-54, C-47. So I've got a little bit of time.
And how does flying the Corsair compare to the P-47, since we're talking about the same 2800 radial?
Well, I'll tell you, they're both uniquely different, and it's a privilege to fly both of them and because they are different, and they both airplanes have different stories to tell to the public, and so it's unique. I mean, the Corsair is a great airplane. It's not as fast as the Thunderbolt, but I'll tell you right now, it's just a pure joy to fly.
Well, thank you for sharing some time with me. We've got a queue up. I'm sure there's a lot of people who want to talk to you, but thank you again, and we'll tell you when it appears on the podcast.
Okay, thank you very much for stopping by.
This is David Vanderhoof. I'm speaking to Jerry Connolly. We're standing in front of a very interesting jet. You want to tell me what we're standing in front of?
This is a Russian L-29 with a modification of a Rolls-Royce Viper engine. The same airplanes that we race in Reno. And the top speed on this airplane is about 504 miles an hour. So it's actually one of the fastest, if not the fastest, subsonic jet warbirds in the United States today.
And you want to, for our listeners, describe a little bit about the paint job on this airplane?
It's sort of a yin-yang type thing in that we have the one side of the aircraft is an American flag, an American eagle being drawn, and the other side is the Russian eagle. So when we do first part of our act where we do a dedication pass for the troops, we show them the American side. Then when I turn around, come the other direction, is when we start the air combat, and I give them the Russian side.
So we have a clear demarcation between good, when you're playing good guy and bad guy.
Yes. And I'm married, so that fits very well.
And tell me, how does the L-29 fly?
It's a very easy aircraft to fly. The airplane is capable up to 9G with external stores, so you can pull the crap out of it and not have to worry about anything failing. And it's a very reliable aircraft.
Well, I want to thank you very much. And like I said, it's a beautiful aircraft. It's bred and glistening, and Colonel Connolly wants to keep an eye on it because it's being crawled around by people. So I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This is David Vanderhoof for the Airplane Geeks. I have a special guest. I have AS2, John Lanson. John Lanson is the crew chief for Blue Angel number 6. John, say hello to the listeners.
Hello, listeners.
John, you want to tell me about your career in the Navy and how you got to be part of the prestigious team, the Blue Angels?
Sure. I've only been in the Navy actually about 4 years. I joined right out of high school. Went to boot camp in 2006. Had a great time, learned how to be a sailor, you know, all that stuff. Went to Pensacola to do my initial schooling, saw the Blue Angels, kind of fell in love with them there. And got orders to Virginia Beach, my first duty station there. Spent about 2 years there and came to the Blue Angels about a year ago. And that's about it. My job with the Blue Angels is a crew chief. We perform engine turn-up operations of the aircraft and flight control checks and all the instrument checks. We basically try to break the aircraft before the pilot gets in it so that we know that it's safe for flight. And we're responsible for the appearance of the aircraft, the setup of the cockpit. We do all the launches and recoveries of the jet, so it's pretty much my jet. He just takes it, borrows it, and gives it back to me later.
And what unit were you with Oceana?
I was at FRC Mid-Atlantic, Site Oceana. So it's a shore facility repair.
So how does it feel to have a big, bright blue jet as your responsibility?
It's outstanding. It's very humbling experience to know that the pilot trusts me with his life and inspecting that aircraft every time after he flies. So it's a lot of responsibility.
Do you like all the travel?
I do. I like the travel. Get to go all over, see all the different air bases around the country, and you know, it's really cool.
Tell me a little bit about the F-18.
F-18. It's about a $28 million aircraft to start off with, so that'll tell you what it's like right there. Weighs about 24,000 pounds dry. It can fly pretty fast. We don't do any maneuvers over the speed of sound. It's got two General Electric 400 motors in them. Let's see specifics. That'll get you pretty much anywhere with the F-18.
So, being a Blue Angel, what does it mean to you?
Blue Angel, the title comes with a lot of responsibility. We wear a crest on our right pocket here that we earn when we come to the team. We don't come to the team with a crest. We have to earn it, go through an initiation process, teaches us how to be a Blue Angel. So to me, a lot of it has to do with representing everyone else out in the fleet, everyone else on the ground, floating on a ship right now, and doing the best to represent them so that, you know, we can show all the hard work that they're doing to everyone else. But that's what we do, basically. We come out here and represent them. So.
And how long of a tour do you have?
It's a 3-year tour here.
And this is year one?
This is year one for me. This is year one for me, so.
You got two more years of fun, huh?
Two more years of fun. It's just been amazing so far. So.
Do you think you'll take, what kind of experiences do you think you'll take back to the fleet?
You get a lot of leaders here at the Blue Angels. A lot of people who really know their job, really know, are experts in their field. So you get a lot of, me being junior, there's a lot of senior people here who can teach me a lot about the Navy. And taken back to the fleet, I'll just become a better leader for it. Better leader, be able to take care of the sailors more, so.
Well, John, I really appreciate your time. I know you're really busy working the flight line, and you got to get that bright blue jet ready for a performance in approximately an hour. But I want to thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me here.
This is David Vanderhoof again. I'm here with Major Dallin Rees of the 99th Reconnaissance Squadron. Major Rees flies the U-2 Black Angel. Major, what's it like to fly that baby?
It's a great airplane to fly. It's very challenging for pilots to fly because its design is made to go high, but that means that it's not really designed to be easy to land or to fly. And so the training is involved in terms of getting the pilots trained to land a tailwheel aircraft with a 104-foot wingspan in a pressure suit and land it tailwheel first. But that challenge is part of what makes it a good assignment for pilots, one that we love to apply for.
How many hours do you spend in the chase car before you get the lander?
Well, that's part of the training to become a U-2 pilot is being checked out in the chase car. And typically, guys who are newly qualified U-2 pilots will end up driving the chase car for two or three missions for every mission that they actually fly. So part of the job is to back up our fellow pilots by driving in the chase car, helping them land, and being that extra set of eyes outside the aircraft.
But you don't mind driving really fast down a runway, do you?
That's part of the perks of the job. We drive muscle cars 100 miles an hour down the runway behind airplanes and fly two different jets that are a lot of fun.
And what's it like flying in a pressure suit?
It's a little bit awkward because it's bulky. We don't fly with it inflated. When it is deflated, it's just a big bulky suit. When it's inflated, it's like being the Michelin Man, and we don't have a lot of mobility. So obviously, we'll fly with it deflated. It's an emergency system that helps us if we eject or lose cabin pressure.
And one last question. It's got a limited window when you're at altitude. How hard is it to keep it between stall and falling out of the sky?
That's a good question. The higher we go, the smaller that window gets, but we trust the autopilot. That's one of the things that the pilot is monitoring the entire flight, is making sure that we stay you know, fast enough to not stall and slow enough to keep from breaking the wings off the airplane. Typically the autopilot does a good job, and the pilots are trained to be able to correct it and hand fly it if necessary, if the autopilot isn't quite up to the task.
And you've got the best view in the world, right?
That's right. Best view from an airplane.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And now I'm with Major Worcester, also of the 9th Reconnaissance Wing. Major Worcester evidently listens to something called the Airplane Geeks. I'm not sure what it is. So, first part, let me ask you, what do you think of the podcast?
I think it's great. I'm really getting into it. Probably listened to about the last 10 episodes or so. Enjoy it.
Well, see, folks, there are people out there besides the four of us who do listen to the show. Well, Paul, tell me how long you've been flying the U2.
I've been in the U2 program for nearly 2 years now.
And what's more fun, flying the plane or driving the car?
Yes, yes, exactly. They're both equally fun.
So what's the longest mission you tend to fly on?
The longest mission that I've personally flown is just a hair under 12 hours, moving a plane around the world.
That's a long time to be in a pressure suit.
That is a long time to be in the seated position and not moving. You're absolutely correct there.
So what's the joy of flying the U-2?
The U-2, you know, for somebody of my generation, one, it's a tail dragger, so that's not very common in and of itself. Two, it's a super high-powered glider, and it's just totally unique in the flight dynamics and everything that it does, and the mission currently that it's doing right now. There is nothing that is close to it, you know. There's not another plane that you know, feels like this plane, at least that I've had a privilege to experience. So previously I flew a B-52, and I've also done a tour as a T-38 instructor pilot at pilot training. You know, and out at Beale, we get to fly both the 38 and the U-2, so that combination together it's awesome. So a real privilege.
So what was the conversion like from flying a big 8-engine bomber to a single-engine glider?
You know, both planes require a heavy but finessed hand to control. The Buff is certainly a massive plane, and you can really kick it around, push it around. This plane is flies by the cables that are attached to the yoke. There's not a hydraulic assisted flight control surface on this aircraft, so it's as hard as you can push, pull, or kick it to move it around, and it constantly, you know, it's constantly trying to throw you. You're not doing this one on accident. You're not ever relaxing in this plane, and that makes it a challenge. That makes it fun.
One last question: what's harder, flying it or working the mission?
It depends. You know, the missions vary greatly around the world. Some of them are very quiet, you know, boring. You know, certainly important, but it doesn't require as much interaction. In some missions, you can be constantly interacting with the guys on the ground, and you're working to protect them with the gear that we have on board. We can give them extra eyes and ears that they don't have, and capabilities that they don't have, and we can pass that down. And the wired nature of the military and the war right now is such that we can get our information out very quickly. And, you know, really, I'm one person in this plane, but it's a very large team that goes in between, you know, obviously always the maintainers that get you up in the plane, but the plane itself, the people that you're communicating with, the intelligence people and the analysts on the back end, and then who is ever disseminating it to the guys on the ground that need that data at the time. And, you know, so that's our small piece of where we can be, and I feel like we have a very unique role that not a lot of other people can fill right now.
Well, Major, I really appreciate your time. You've got a lot of other questions to answer, I'm sure. But and most of all, thank you for listening to our podcast.
Yeah, thanks. Keep it up, and keep the Aussies in line.
Oh, a slam to the Australia desk. Did you hear that, guys? This is David Vinterhoff. I'm standing next to a SP-2C Helldiver, the only flying one left in the world. I'm going to introduce you to Ted Short of the Commemorative Air Force. Ted, what's your affiliation with this airplane?
I've been associated with it since 1994. I just travel with it and do all the wiping down and changing oil and stuff like that. We just do whatever we can to make it, keep it running, keep it flying in the air.
And do you have a background with Helldivers before this lovely bird?
No, my time was spent in the infantry, walking around on the ground. But I always loved the old warbirds, and my brother got me interested in the CAF, and I joined it in 1977. I've been playing around with these things ever since.
And what's your favorite part of the Helldiver?
All of it, I guess. I have no favorite part. All of it.
What's it like to fly in her?
It's really, other than being terribly noisy, it's really pretty comfortable. The only thing is, if it sets out in the rainwater will gather in the fuselage. And right below your feet, in this back seat, there's a little drain hole. But when you're air flying, all the water runs back. It don't drain; it blows up. So,
not only do you get to fly, but you get an in-flight shower.
Right, you definitely get an in-flight shower. It just a fine mist is always constant till the water dissipates.
And how many hours of maintenance do you put on this a year?
For a year, it depends upon what we have to go through. We try to work on an annual, just year-long annuals, but this last year was pretty expensive. We were coming back from, I think, North Carolina and back part in the air. And so the pilot put it down in Jackson, Mississippi to check it out. Everything seemed all right. Next morning he fired up, was ready to leave, and the throttle, it wouldn't go below 1,500 RPM, so taxied back and pulled the engine, and it swallowed a bolt from the air intake, and it chewed up the supercharger. So that got very expensive. Had to pull the engine out, send it off, have it checked, make sure nothing's hurt.
I'm sorry, Dave. You have to go around.
The prop had a problem on it, so it's not so much how much maintenance as how many dollars you spend on it.
Yeah, I'm sure that flying a one-of-a-kind aircraft is not cheap.
Well, when something breaks, you hope you have enough left to use it as a pattern, because you have to reinvent it every time. So.
Well, given the look of this baby, you've reinvented the wheel a couple of thousand times, and it still looks gorgeous.
Yeah, they crashed it in 1982 at an air show in Harlingen and broke it in three pieces. The engine came off, came underneath, and took the tail part off. He got it in the air about 100 feet, quit, and crashed it. Our wing took it over as a project in 82, and it took us a little over 6 years and a couple dollars. We finally got it back in the air in 88.
Well, on behalf of my listeners, thank you very much, because it's a wonderful piece of history.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 16, May 30th through June 5th. On June 1st, 1961, United Airlines merges with a competitor, creating then the world's largest airline. Unlike the most recent version of this, United was the better-managed airline. The loser in the merger was Capital Airlines. The result gives United the best route network in the United States. It's interesting how history repeats itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
June 2nd, 1910, Charles Rolls of Rolls-Royce fame flies his Wright Flyer. The Wright Flyer was one of six licensed built by the Short brothers. Rolls takes off and makes the first round-trip crossing over the English Channel. He actually flew it faster than when Berlau flew his crossing, and that was only one way. June 2nd, 1914, Glenn Curtiss flies a modified Langley Aerodrome. The flight chartered by the Smithsonian was an attempt to vindicate Langley. The Smithsonian wanted to prove that Langley actually flew before the Wright brothers. They displayed the aerodrome as the world's first heavier-than-air aircraft. Because of this display, the Wright Flyer lived in London until 1946. Orville returned it after the Smithsonian admitted that Curtiss made significant changes to Langley's plans, therefore causing the aircraft to fly. In honor of our 99th episode, we have June 2nd, 1943. The 99th Pursuit Squadron flies its first operational combat mission over Italy. The pilots were made up of the legendary Tuskegee Airmen. The African-American pilots would go on to prove that armed services could be successfully integrated. June 3rd, 1925, the Goodyear blimp Pilgrim makes its first flight. It is the first blimp to have an indoor cabin. Goodyear had been producing envelopes for other groups like the United States Navy, and Pilgrim was their first self-promotion one. June 4th, 1930, Lieutenant Apollo Sutek breaks the world altitude record for seaplanes. He takes his F-3W Apache, a U.S. Navy potential Schneider Trophy aircraft, to an altitude of 43,166 feet. Apollo Sutek was his field is the name of Oceana's airfield, NAS Oceana's airfield. And on June 5th, 1967, American Airlines takes delivery of a Boeing 707-120B. The 707 is the 1,000th jet airliner produced by the company. And last but not least, first flights that occurred during the week of May 30th through June 5th. The Douglas DC-8 on May 30th, 1958. And that's the way it was, May 30th through June 5th.
Thanks, David. You mentioned the Tuskegee Airmen. I had an opportunity, it might have been a couple of years ago now, to meet with a number of the folks from that organization. And, you know, I have to say it's sort of a fascinating conversation to listen to these guys talk about the Tuskegee Airmen and, you know, the things that happened and didn't happen, some of the history of that. It was really great.
And the guys I have met from that organization are the greatest, nicest guys.
Yes, yes.
There is a reason why I have a red-tailed Mustang in my model collection.
Uh-huh.
They were the best at what they did.
Very cool. Very cool. Thanks, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Hey, Steve, do you know what I'm thinking?
No.
Neither do I. Tell me what you think I'm thinking.
I'm thinking it's time for the Australia Desk, episode 99.
I think you may be right.
Actually, you know, Grant, really, it's only about episode 55 of the Australia Desk.
Oh, that's a good point. But, you know, one Australia Desk is worth two airplane geeks, so therefore we've actually up 110.
Well, that's right. In fact, we were actually thinking about it for the 44 previous, so I think that counts for something.
There you go.
Welcome, folks, to World Tail Day. Well, in fact, it's not World Tail Day today, but David Vanderhoof informed me during the week, in fact, that it was World Tail Day. And, of course, to all of you Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy fans around the universe, and that includes me, Grant, and David.
The secret is to bang the rocks together, guys.
Yes, there you go.
Actually, Steve, you do know that I already knew it was Tau Day, and I just didn't make a big thing of it because I thought everyone in the universe knew it was Tau Day.
Well, Grant, yes, and David tells me the other day that, I mean, I thought I'd done well reading the entire series, the trilogy of six books. I thought I'd done well reading that so many times, but David says he's read the entire series at least 14 times, so all I can say to that is...
Let's face it, Dave's one hoopy frood who really knows where his towel is.
Absolutely. I sass that hoopy frood.
You gotta love a word that has multiple meanings, don't you?
Yes.
And speaking of multiple meanings, let's talk about financial reporting.
Yes.
A subject that's near and dear to Dan Boy Wonder's heart, and we're going to take on with some trepidation because definitely we cannot speak to it quite the same level that junior economist there does, but let's give it a whirl, shall we?
Yes, let's fire away. Virgin Blue shares plunge over profit warning, screams the headlines.
That's right. Virgin Blue has stunned, shocked, surprised, and other such S-words to the stock market when it announced that it was dramatically reducing its predicted earnings for this financial year, which finishes at the end of June. It was saying that instead of being down the low end of 80 to 110 million, it said it was more likely to be 20 to 40 million. When this news came out on an already, shall we say, scared stock market with recent collapses due to various mining taxes and the problems going on around the world, especially over in Europe, the reaction was quite swift and dramatic, and they lost well over 25% of their value in one trading day.
Of course, their share price is not particularly stellar anyway, Grant. And it says here, for instance, one of the reports I was looking at says their share price dropped 28% on the day, or 12 cents.
That's right. Their share price isn't really huge, but they still had a few hundred million wiped off them. And they're also getting the ASX throwing a couple of questions to them about, well, why is this only coming out now? But there's two major reasons that I see for it, and they have alluded to these. One is the market confidence within Australia has fallen recently. We've been pummeled by a few things and lots of evidence that the current government just can't really figure itself out too well. No surprise, of course. They're a political party, so we all know how Steve and I feel about that. Mm. But there's that. Plus, also, Borghetti has just come in. And John Borghetti, here's my theory. He comes from the Qantas school from a very long time back. And for a long time there, Qantas was always underestimating its results. They always look good, but they would always come in with results that are better at the end of the year and pleasantly surprise analysts. That was the usual theme many years ago until recently. And I wouldn't be surprised if the fact that John has come in is an indication that he's going to try and do something similar. He's taken a look at what's coming through, the fact that Virgin expects domestic airfares to drop by 10%, that they're seeing a weakening in the market for domestic travel, all these kind of things. And he's gone, right, let's go worst case, scare everyone now, get it out, so that if at the end of the year we do come in at this level, we're okay. And if we can come in with anything better, it's good. So they're seeing it as a clearing of the desks.
Yeah, so of course you won't get a more slick operator than John Borghetti. And Grant, I actually thought their marketing strategy to release that was quite well done, actually. They put that press release out in a nice book with large friendly letters on the front that says, "Don't panic."
Yeah, space cookies.
Yay.
Hand me the scare sheet.
I think our listeners might be clicking onto our theme by now, Grant, do you think?
I hope so. I hope so. We've been pretty obvious. But interesting that also at the same time that Virgin Blue was talking about massive drops and weakening in the market, Qantas released their expectations that they are on track for their predicted profit, which is interesting because they're in the same market. So they, of course, they're not going through the fun of having V Australia and trying to get all that international side of things set up. They're already there. So it's quite possible that Qantas may very well be on track for their predicted profit, but maybe they're just not willing to acknowledge that the same level of doubt that Virgin is willing to go ahead with. I mean, it's an interesting time. Our major regional carrier, Rex, they expect their profit to be similar to last year, no increase. That's still 20 to 23 million, but they've had a bit of a pummeling on the stock market as well for that. But it's tightening up here. It still is tightening.
Yeah, of course, Qantas, they might say that they're on track to get the profit they predicted, but as we've been reporting pretty consistently, Grant, over the last 12 months we've been doing the AusDesk, their profits have taken a huge hit. I mean, they are under a lot of pressure themselves and have been for quite some time. Yeah, I'll grant you they don't have the same sort of pressures that Virgin have with what was setting up a new airline and such, but still, it'll be interesting to see what their profits are. They might be on track, but they won't be stellar. Not by their standards, anyway. Anyway, mate, let's quickly cross the Tasman and have a bit of a chat about our friends at Air New Zealand on the outer spiral arm of the, Pacific galaxy.
Yeah, that's right. Air New Zealand are trying to get in with the sub-ether wave bands. They're going to introduce SMS and email on their 777-300s when they bring those online later in the year. This is going to be available for mobile devices, no voice, just data comms for SMS and emails and so on for your Crackberries, iPhones, that kind of thing. The rules of the air are that you're going to have your phone on silent. They don't want lots of beep beeps and weird chirp noises and so on. If you want to shell out the big bucks, you will be able to have data connectivity for your portable device on their long-distance flights.
Yes, and of course, if anybody caught the last edition on our show of the View from the Lounge, just imagine how much that's going to impress our friend Anthony Simmons.
Well, I guess so long as they're not beeping and buzzing and flashing and beeping and buzzing. Anyhow, know where that's going.
You get the picture.
But kudos to Air New Zealand. That's going to be interesting for them to introduce that. At least they haven't gone with voice.
Yeah, they're the group general manager of Air New Zealand. And Ed Sims says here that feedback from their customers has shown that they wish to be able to text and check emails to stay in touch with friends, family and colleagues during their long-haul flights.
They're installing what's known as Pico cells, which are tiny little network cells and Wi-Fi and so on. And what this allows is your device to actually be turned on and operational, but it's locked onto that Pico cell.
All right, so that'll be interesting. And I'm sure if Air New Zealand are once again at the forefront there in this region of introducing new technology and just thinking a little bit differently to most legacy carriers, I'm sure that it won't take too long before Australian-based carriers are doing exactly the same. Grant, speaking of technology that, perhaps hasn't been working too well, just before we finish, Hamish, the Australian Defence Force has been having a bit of trouble with its new helicopters, the MRH-90s. In fact, the fleet, they've only got 11 at the moment. They've all been grounded after a quote-unquote catastrophic engine failure on a flight near Adelaide back in April.
Tricky. Yes, that's correct. The MRH-90s have actually been grounded. I'm not sure if they're back in the air yet. The Australian Defence Force has been doing a reasonably good job of trying to keep this information not so much totally hush-hush and hidden, but they're doing a good job of trying to suppress it and not make a big deal of it. These MRH-90s, they're trying to get navalised versions of them for the use on the various warships we've got here. And, there's also a local operation in Brisbane that does the final assembly and check flights of these aircraft when the components come in from Europe. So there's a lot of vested interest in keeping them around, as David said when he pointed it out to us as well. Probably should have bought Sikorsky, hey?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Don't forget, the Black Hawks are known as Crash Hawks.
The MRH-90s are powered by Rolls-Royce Turbo... How do you pronounce that, Grant? Turbo Mecha? Turbo Mesa? I'm never really sure.
I just want to go with Turbo Mecha.
And there you go, Turbo Mecha. And Grant, of course, you are the resident linguist here, so we'll go with that.
That's a scary thought.
These are RTM 322-01/9 engines. One of them failed quite catastrophically. We don't really know why. Kind of bothers me that Defence did try to cover this up. I mean, you know, it's going to get found out sooner or later. The Defence Force has 46 of these aircraft on order. You know, obviously we need to find out what that was, and it's better that they make those findings public.
Yeah, indeed.
Of course, as we've spoken about before, the other controversial aircraft buy that they're making at the moment is the F-35, and we've talked before about all the problems that it's having there. So the last thing that the government wants to have on its hands, I guess, is another dud buy, or potentially dud buy, but yeah, very impressive machine otherwise. So let's hope they get those things running sooner rather than later.
Indeed, indeed. Now, a question for you, Steve. Is your Babelfish not working that you had some problems with that word?
Yes, well, that's exactly right, Grant. I don't know what I did with my Babelfish.
Oh, mate, we're just going to have to go and find you a new one. Have you got your sub-ether sensomatic there?
Yes, I'll just whip it out now, mate.
Okay, well, hang on. Let's just both hold on to it and see if we can hitch a ride on a passing spaceship.
Well, you know, Grant, the thing is, if I had a Babelfish in my ear, it would make you redundant as our resident linguist.
Ah, okay. Let's just put that sub-ether sensomatic away, huh?
Yes, don't panic. Anyway, folks, of course, we know that the Airplane Geeks episode 99 was actually, for a change, recorded before we recorded this segment, which is not usually what happens. So those little devils, Grant, we can say and do anything we like on this segment, I guess, and they'll never know until it's too late.
Oh, that's a really good point. For once, we're in the past.
Anyway, folks, we'd just like to acknowledge, of course, that it is the Memorial Day long weekend over in the United States. And so, Grant, a tip of the hat there to all the US servicemen and women. They do a great job, and of course, Australia has a lot to be thankful for when it comes to the military forces of the United States. They have really helped us along in the past, and of course, Australian forces are actively serving with US forces today. So, yeah, we just like to acknowledge. It's not really something that you'd celebrate, I guess, Memorial Day, is it, Grant? But something that should be acknowledged, and the wonderful effort that our military forces do all across the world.
Well, there you go. It's a lot like our Anzac Day and things like that. Just a word for any US forces coming down here to Australia to do exercises and so on out in the middle of the Australian desert, just watch out for drop bears, and there's this black stuff called Vegemite that you smear on the back of your neck and it keeps them away.
Is that what they use Vegemite for? I spread it on my toast.
Well, I do that too, but apparently it keeps the drop bears away.
Anyway, folks, on that pleasant thought, we'll talk to you next week for episode 100. Looking forward to that, Grant.
Woohoo! Heck yeah!
Until next week, I'm Steve Fisher.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
All right, that's it for this week. We'd like to thank Steve Fisher and Grant McCarran from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk Report. Thanks, David, for the great interviews we listened to. That was it must have been quite an event.
Oh, it was fantastic. I'm looking forward to June 4th, 5th, and 6th at Reading, Pennsylvania at Spatz Field. The Mid-Atlantic Air Museum is having their World War II commemorative weekend, so I'm hoping to bring back some more interviews.
That's great. We also have some interesting guests coming up in future episodes. I think we've got Scott Spangler coming up, right, Rob?
Hey, Scott. All right, yeah. My co-writer at Jetwine.com, but Scott was also the editor of the EAA's Sport Aviation magazine for many years. And boy, what an opinionated guy.
More than you?
I'll tell you. Oh, you know, I should get him to work for me.
Oh.
Wait, he does. That's right. Yeah, he's going to be a good guy, I think. And then, of course, we've got Bruce Landsberg coming on, and We've got a few more in the works here. Hopefully, somebody from Cessna is going to be on to talk to us about the rolling out of the new Skycatchers now that they're really starting to come down the assembly line.
Yeah, great,
so to speak.
And we've also got lined up Lewis Smith. He's a former DC-10 captain.
Oh yeah, that's the guy from FlightOps.com, which is exactly. The big pilot information service that gets quoted in the big-time papers all the time.
So a lot of interesting guests coming up.
Yeah.
All right, David, tell people where they can find you online.
They can find me online on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, or you can check out my blog at whatjustflewby.com.
And Rob, how about you?
Well, I'm usually hanging around at Jetwine on Twitter or at jetwine.com, the blog. But you never know. As last week, I was down in Jamaica on vacation. But as David was so good to point out, I got out of Dodge just in time.
Yeah, seriously.
You see, folks, he goes to Jamaica and they start having riots.
Just let us know where you're headed next.
Who'd have thought that I was that damn popular down there?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my Lord. I don't think that was it, actually.
All right, I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. See airplanegeeks.com for show notes and listener comments. You can also follow us on Twitter at Airplane Geeks. Send your email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, or you can call our voicemail line.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
And don't forget our Facebook page, where the pictures of our articles will be posted tonight.
Yeah, fantastic. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. This is going to be episode 100.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And so we've got a few things planned for that.
I don't feel that old, actually. Do you guys?
No.
I'm only one in podcast years.
Yes. Yeah. Sounds good. Well, good night, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Good night, all.
Our first story comes from Arrived OK. This is titled The Future of Airliners. So, this is,
well, you don't sound like you believe that.
Well,
that was truly a Brady moment.
Okay, ready to start?
Yeah. me.
Okay. Hydrating. They used it. Did you hear that, David, on Doctor Who the other night when she said she was hydrating?
Yes, I did.
Yes, I thought of Dan when I heard that. So, anyway, sorry.
Sugar, do 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 do.
Solid red light. There you go.
Caution, warning, Grant's had sugar.
Yes.
Hey, Steve, do you know what I'm thinking?
You have to do that again. I was grunting in the middle of it.
Oh, no. And now it's the grunt show.